Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Here's a joke from my son. What did the bum say to the other bum? That's a bummer. You know, not for everyone. Look, thanks to everyone who's come to see the previews of Can I Have My Ball Back? It's been going really, really well, and I'm really pleased with how the show's turning out. It's officially on tour now from Wednesday. I'll be at the Leicester Square Theatre. A couple of tickets left. Lots of press coming to that one. It'd be lovely to sell out, but there are a few other London gigs not selling as well. So if you're going to come to London, maybe look up those other London gigs. And then this week I'll be in St Albans on Thursday, Gloucester on Friday, Chorley on Saturday, which is sold out, but you can join the waiting list, and Glasgow on Sunday. Two shows. I think the earlier show is sold out. Check with the venue, but the later show has some availability. Come along if you can. If you enjoy these podcasts and like them being free, then the great way to pay me back is to buy a ticket to a show or buy a download or a book from gofasterstripe.com. But you can just keep listening for free as well. That pays me back also. So, you know, no pressure. But I'd love to see you there. If you just know me from the podcast and don't know me as a stand-up, I'm pretty good as a stand-up. It's a good show. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's only made about seven men faint so far. So, you know, are you brave enough to take the challenge? Let's sit back, relax, and enjoy whichever podcast you're listening to now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems, too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Look, it's me. I'm at the Clapham Grand. There's incompetent Sandman George in the background. It's the first time I've seen him in a year. Welcome to another episode of Rahala Stapa. It's not at the Clapham Grand, this one. This one's with Danny Robbins and recorded in my attic. There's a lot about ghosts in here, but I'm recording two gigs at the Clapham Grand and they will go out very soon on this feed, so look out for those. I hope you watch them live. Hopefully we'll be doing more of this in the future and you can see us again. It's just exciting to be out. Look. People are turning up. There's a glitter ball. Look at that. It's amazing. Can you see the glitter? There it is. Anyway, thanks very much for watching. I hope you'll enjoy this podcast. Do become a badger. GoFasterStripe.com/badgers. Look, I got injured myself. It's a terrible time. All right. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Rahala Stapa. George calls it that. Rahala Stapa. Hello, please welcome a man who's got two broken hoovers. It's Richard Herring. Hello. Yep, two graters. I've got three hoovers. Two of them are broken and the other one doesn't work very well. Yep. Oh, how the other half live. Welcome to Richard Herring's Loft Situated Transmission podcast. Come on, that could be every week. Though I was hanging around in this haunted house that if you're watching, you can see. I'm in a haunted house. Ooh, spooky. All the ghosts who live in there call it Rahala Stapa. It's on a Ouija board. That's what they use a Ouija board to communicate. That's there. Whew. Might be some more talk about ghosts in this week's show. Everything's going all right. Homeschooling's still annoying. I'm still doing dry January, even though it's February, and that's going okay. I'm drinking peppermint tea, tea pigs. Sorry, they don't sponsor me. I'm not giving them an advert for free. Get in touch, Ian Tea Pigs. Show us the colour of your free tea, and then we'll have a talk. While I remember, if for people watching this on Twitch, we're doing some live in a theatre, Rahala Stapa's, this Saturday, the 6th of February. They will go out as podcasts down the line if you're listening to this too late, so you will be able to see them. But if you want to watch them live,
pay a little bit of money to help the Clapham Grand go, which is where we're filming them, and help us make some more podcasts. If you've enjoyed a year of free podcasts and feel like paying £7 for one or £14 for two, we're there at 5 p.m. where my guest will be Nish Kumar, and 6:45 p.m. where my guest will be Lou Sanders, and we'll be in the same room, socially distanced. And you can be in the audience online, and I will talk to the audience in this section of the show. So there's a chance for you to actually be. I might ask you some emergency questions. You could be on the actual show if you buy your tickets and come along and watch them live. Good. So please do go to richchang.com/gigs to find out about that. Yes, I have. I had a fun thing this week. First of all, I don't think I said this last week, but I've discovered my son thinks that high fives are called hand fives. What a fucking idiot. Who's teaching these kids? It's me at the moment, admittedly. I'm not telling them not. In fact, I've started calling them hand fives as well. So that just somewhere down the line, he's going to look like an idiot in front of some people. He's trying to look cool in front of hand five. He's only three. 28 years old he is. Oh, no, I ruined it. We foolishly bought a Dyson, two Dyson vacuum cleaners we've got. We've got an older one and a newer one. Before I really knew the whole Brexit implications about that. But they break quite easily and they're very expensive to repair and the parts are very expensive. But I found a man in the Hatfield you can drive to his house and he's an old man. And you hand over your Dysons and your other vacuum cleaners and he will mend them for you. He was complaining about the cost of Dyson stuff. He doesn't use the Dyson things. The switch broke on it. So he couldn't get there. And he rang me up and said, it's going to be £30 to get a new switch from, you can't get them from Dyson. And he was worried. He thought that would be too high a price for me to pay. But I said, no, let's go for it, mate. But it was like having a drug dealer, but I was giving him Hoovers and he was then going to repair the Hoovers. But it was quite fun to drive to the outskirts of Hatfield, make an exchange. Made me feel alive. Made me feel good. So that's it. If you like the watching stuff on Twitch, I play snooker on Monday nights, and I also do the puppet show usually on Thursday nights. Twitch.tv/RKHerring if you haven't caught on yet. If you're with Amazon Prime, don't forget that you can give us free money every month. And if you've done it already, you just have to remember to go back and subscribe. We take it from Ian Amazon. I know it's a new Ian Amazon now. He's regenerated, but he's still called Ian Amazon. Hands down from father to son. Please try and take his money. We got some quite good money from you in the first place, but now it's dwindled a bit. So let's steal some of Ian Amazon's money and put it to good use of making stupid puppet shows. Did somebody say stupid? Look at this fucking thing. Okay. Donkey, why are you wearing that t-shirt? Okay, we're going to get on with it. My guest doesn't know what's going on. My guest is probably best known for playing Brian O'Green on the seminal Radio 2, I nearly said BBC 2, Radio 2 sketch show that everyone quotes and talks about all the time because it's the greatest sketch show of all time. That was then, this is now. Twitatin, twitatin. It's Danny Robbins, ladies and gentlemen. Here he is. Hello.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
You haven't changed at all since I last saw you, which is probably 15 years ago. Have I seen you recently?
I don't know.
You look exactly the same.
Yeah, I have that illusion we've seen each other recently through social media. But I'm trying to maintain an ageless state here.
You're doing very well.
I'm basically like Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire. I'm sitting in a very dark room as you see me, so you can't see the reality. I'm in my shed in the garden with very few lights on.
It's very nice. Well, you've kept your hair, and that's the important thing, Danny. As long as you can keep that hair, it'll start to grey. Maybe it has started to grey. Maybe you're colouring it in a bit.
Can you see my headphones have actually sort of disappeared into my hair? They've sort of morphed into one mighty black helmet.
What do you remember about That Was Then, This Is Now? I can't remember who wrote that and who was the presenter of it, but
it was happy days. It was a weird little time
in my life. I think that for those of you who don't know, it was a sketch show that I hosted and fronted, and then Danny Robbins and Dan Tetzel and Emma Kennedy were in it, and Christian Riley. It was sort of, as it occurs to me, And then with an extra bloke in it, then wasn't as it occurs to me.
You just didn't invite me back.
How did you feel when you saw As It Occurs to Me it was coming out, well, and you weren't in it?
Very left out, certainly. Hurt, jilted. You were asking earlier about why we hadn't seen each other for 15 years. But yeah.
I don't think it was anything personal. No, I don't think there was anything personal. But I think it was just that there was too. I felt that was then. This now there was too many people in it for the certainly for the time slot on Radio 2, because we were all kind of trying to write stuff and put stuff into it.
Well, that's very flattering. But I realised though that the voice I do for Brian O'Green. Or did for Brian O'Green is essentially the voice I do for my character Ian in The Cold Swedish Winter on Radio 4. So in a way, it's an homage to those days together. It's the same kind of nasally
time,
voice.
Because it was a conspiracy. He was a conspiracy theory nut who came up with crazy conspiracy theories that kind of spiraled out of control. And now it wouldn't even be a joke now if you put it on. People would go, yeah, that's a good one. Good idea.
Though I think he did link everything back to Star Trek, and I think people may not get those references now.
You never know. I was going to give you some trivia about Brian O'Green, because this was...
Oh, go on.
He was based on Danny Bryan and Dave Green, who we were at university with, who went on to do... were the first people on the internet. They did Need to Know and all sorts of stuff, and they're still very big cogs in the kind of internet business, I think. The first time the character appeared, I think, was in Time Gentlemen Please, where he's played by Ben Moore. And they were in a show called Day of the Trivheads. They were on a trivia team. It was Ben Moore, Colin Baker from Doctor Who, I think. And it was one of the Doctor Whos anyway. And Luke Youngblood was, I thought he was Danny O'Brien, Brian O'Gree, but he wasn't. He was someone else. But he went on to play Magnitude in Community.
Oh, wow.
So you are linked to Magnitude in Community by 2 degrees of separation.
So are you saying that Brian O'Green was like Lucy Robinson in Neighbours, and that he kind of morphed into different people?
There might have even been one before, because I'm sure it's a name me and Stu use quite a lot.
I was the brunette Brian, was I?
I think you're the Tennant. You're the David Tennant Brian O'Green. Right. We went, let's get a handsome guy to be Brian O'Green. See how that works out. Now back to the big nerds. That's pretty cool. I've worked with Magnet. He was also in Harry. He was one of the only black characters in Harry Potter who spoke. I think he had about two lines. Luke Youngblood, he's doing pretty well. Hope you're all right, Luke, if you're watching. Anyway, let's crack on. Look, the reason, the impetus to have you on, which I should have done before, because actually you've done so much stuff. I'm not just going to talk about ghosts, but we're mainly going to talk about ghosts because you have got a podcast out right now, which I highly recommend to anyone interested in either who are skeptical of ghosts as I am, or who are kind of into ghosts, which I also am. It's called the Battersea Poltergeist, which I Googled and looked up, and it's such, and you say you're in the thing going, oh, it's such a famous case. And I know what you're like. I think you just made the whole thing. I think you've made it up. You put a few little bits online, like a picture or two, and someone's written a book about it on the Kindle, which could be you. Is it a real story, or have you made it up?
It really is. I mean, I think the thing is that it was huge in 1956. 65 years ago, this is just insanely massive. So, I mean, you know, most people probably have heard of the Enfield Poltergeist. It was in the 70s, and it's, you know, The Conjuring 2 was made about it, though they sort of injected a homicidal nun as a baddie into that. But basically, I mean, this was bigger than Enfield back in 56. It was like on the front pages of all the newspapers. Shirley, the teenager at the heart of it, was on primetime BBC television with Cliff Mitchell-Moore, who was this guy who was basically the Hugh Edwards of his day. He went on to front like the moon landings and the Kennedy assassination. He was kind of big news guy. And he was getting her to try and channel her poltergeist at 7 o'clock on BBC television. And you know, there were questions in the Houses of Parliament. Like the Home Secretary was actually talking about this poltergeist. So it was enormous. And she had, you know, a journalist camped outside the house, and the family was under siege from the press. But then it just kind of got forgotten about, really. And I think partly that was because the family wanted to forget about it. And partly it's because it was 56 and it was long before things were kind of routinely filmed. And, you know, Enfield, there is much more documentary evidence on that. But so it's like this undiscovered gem of a poltergeist case. And I think what I've realized doing this is that people love a ghost story. People even more love a poltergeist story because you get that tangibility of things flying around the room. And then to find a poltergeist story that people don't know, it's like, I mean, it's been brilliant to see that the paranormal community, I was going to say the poltergeist community, they're very animated about it. But the paranormal community are just loving this. They're kind of creaming their pants over the fact that they've got this new case to look at. And I'm being bombarded by emails at the moment of people wanting to know like the specifics of where exactly the house was and, you know, all these details about the case. And it's brilliant.
Because it's quite rare. I mean, especially when something's been headline news, it's quite rare that there isn't like a Wikipedia page or anything about it. I don't know if it might have one, but there was when I looked up, because I thought, well, I want to find, you know, that's, it's very good for your podcast because it's very hard to find out any information about what actually happened. So you have this, we're about halfway through the series, I guess you're doing, is it a series of six?
Yeah, a series of eight, actually, eight.
Yeah, so we're coming up to halfway through. And it's, you know, there's a lot of questions still to be answered that I don't particularly want you to answer now, as I'm sure you neither do you. But, and the real surprise is that Shirley's still with us.
I know.
Or at least was when you recorded.
I mean, we are pushing her hard, but she is brilliant. I mean, this morning I got an interview request from Australian Breakfast Television for Shirley. Shirley's fast becoming an international celeb. She was on this morning with Philip and Holly the other day, but she's brilliant because she is an incredible storyteller, an incredible witness, and she remembers these events like they were yesterday. She's 80, and this was when she was 15. It's just incredible, the clarity of her memories. And the thing, though, that really drew me into this and really made me want to take on this, and actually the point where I felt, yes, this could be eight parts, was just this little moment where she's talking to me and she says, I'm worried it could bring him back. And it sends this little shiver down your spine. And it's something that I've noticed a few listeners picking up on and spotting. But it's that moment where you are totally convinced that she believes this 100%. Yeah. And so then, like, whatever comes from that point, whatever you believe, if you believe it's a haunting or you know, that it's all in the minds of the people, I just think that takes you to such interesting territory, because this person is totally convinced that all of this incredibly mad stuff happened. They're still convinced 65 years later. So it's immensely powerful. Whatever happened then, the strange noises, the objects flying, she is totally convinced of it.
Yeah, she could be lying, though, Danny. That's the thing.
She could, but do you think that would involve me being a terrible judge of character?
It would, but I think like the thing with people who lie about stuff is they're good. The ones who get away with it,
again,
are good at it.
But it makes it even more interesting. I sort of feel whichever way you come to this, you know, even if you're convinced she's lying her pants off, then it's equally interesting to follow that, you know.
Well, I would just say from the most recent episode, I know you've done a little. I've been listening to all of your stuff, Dan, in the last week, and I've listened to all of this series. I know you did a little extra catch up with viewers' idea or listeners' ideas and other bits of information. But in episode 3, which is the one that's just gone out, the grandmother goes out of the room because she's scared just before the poltergeist turns up. Do you not find that a bit suspicious? She goes, "Oh no, I'm not having this with all these. It's against God and nature. I'm going out." Do you reckon she might have been in on it a little bit? I mean, that's what I think. I think there might be a little bit of collusion going on there.
I think that's what I'm enjoying, and hopefully people are enjoying that you've got this cast of characters. And it is like, it's a detective story. The idea was always to do like a true crime podcast about a ghost story. And you've got, you know, you've got the adopted brother, the mum who's kind of very frustrated and is kind of housebound due to her illness and you know, hasn't really left the house. The grandmother who's also housebound and kind of, you know, has these very strong religious beliefs and beliefs in the supernatural, and you know, and just these all these interesting characters, and you are kind of wondering, like, you know, has one of these people had something to do with the haunting, you know? So it is
fascinating. I know you've always been fascinated with ghosts, and I've always been fascinated with the supernatural stuff, and I think especially when I was younger and more kind of susceptible to it, though I still the beauty of this and of the series called Haunted, which I think we'll talk a little bit about as well. And let's stick with this one for the moment, is that, you know, it's very hard to be entirely skeptical about it because there are enough weird things happening that you know, as I said, you just feel it on in a way that when you get the cynics and the scientists on, their kind of explanations are almost as far-fetched as it being a ghost. So you know, as much as I'm going, oh, come on, this is bullshit. When they come and go, this is bullshit because of this. You go, oh, that's fucking bullshit, you expert. That would. It can't be that. It can't be that all these things have happened at once and created this thing. But so I think that's what's interesting is because even in your own mind, you're sort of being pulled in two different directions.
Totally. And I think one of the things when you talk to skeptics and, you know, psychologists who try to explain these things is that one of the big problems that they face is that their explanations are very boring. And complicated, you know. And actually, the beauty of ghosts is that it's beautifully simple. And I think that's why skeptics have such an uphill battle trying to convince people, because their explanation takes a lot of explaining. It's complicated. It involves scientific terms, and it's just not as satisfying or exciting or as newsworthy.
No,
but I mean,
you sort of wanted. Oh, really, you know, I think you want it to be true, don't you? You want all these things to be real, and I think you're, you know, fairly level-headed about it, but you would love it if it was true.
I love to believe in the magic of it. I love the story of it, and I've never understood the kind of need to kind of pour loads of cold water on it. I think it's brilliant when people are genuinely scared about a ghost to be able to offer them scientific explanations and to say it's to do with, you know, sleep paralysis or, you know, that state between sleeping and waking, hypnagogic state. But I think, you know, when you've got a great ghost story, you want to run with it and enjoy it. And very early on when we were making Haunted, I sort of said to myself, you know, I want this show to be equally enjoyed by believers and skeptics. And I want to sort of have a foot in both camps. And I don't want to be the guy who's sort of, you know, debunking at the end of it. And because, frankly, I mean, who's going to want to tell you their ghost story if all you do at the end of it is go, like, nah, it wasn't real. Sorry, next, you know. And so I feel like at the end of Battersea Poltergeist, you know, we'll have loads of theories about it, and there'll be very strong theories on both the skeptic side and the believer side. We've got two experts with very conflicting viewpoints on it, Kieran O'Keefe and Evelyn Hollow. But at the end of it, I mean, I would feel devastated if Shirley felt like we'd sort of taken her for a ride at the end of the thing and just sort of, you know, said, oh, none of it was real at the end. And I think the thing about her story is that it is so genuinely puzzling. There are so many bizarre elements to it that each time you think you've got some light on the case, suddenly you plunge down a real dark alley, and it's like a labyrinth. You're constantly turning these corners. You think you've got it cracked, and then, oh no, there's something truly, truly weird's happened.
And does the, without going into absolute specifics, does the key that starts it all off, does that come back into it at any point? Do we find out what that key was or is, or is it just?
I mean, no, the key definitely comes back in, and the key is significant. I mean, I think that the thing that people will have to decide is how it's significant and in what way is it significant. You know, is it the haunted object, or is it, you know, the object that kind of kicks off some intensely interesting kind of psychological drama in the family? You know, I think that's what I'm loving is that you've got two rival sides. I mean, it basically is as binary and diverse as Brexit. This, I mean, it is incredible. The anger that can be generated from some people. Like, I've got a mate who's just so skeptic. He's like, why would you want to do this? Why would you be interested? It doesn't exist. And furious, you know. And on the other end of it, I've got really ardent believers who are kind of sending me their stories and offering me, you know, kind of, you know, explanations that are entirely paranormal. And, you know, and I sort of relish both of those things. You know, I love
good.
It.
You know? I agree. You should. It is brilliant, though. And I think the series Haunted as well, which came before this from 2017, 2018, is also just is beautifully and brilliantly researched. But we may talk about that in a sec, as I said. I'm kind of interested in, like, A, I'm interested in why we're, as humans, we kind of want to be scared, right? I mean, there's my son, who's three, is very easily scared of stuff and very obsessed with ghosts, but he loves it as well. So, like, he's terrified but loves being terrified. And I think that stays with us, right? So he's almost egging it on. He thinks he's, you know, we live, as I was telling you before, we live in a house from 1702. He has a bedroom that has a door that used to go into our room. So it used to have doors all the way around so each room led to each room, but there's this blocked up door that he's obsessed with.
Oh, God,
and
okay.
He's talked about people coming through and it being a prison behind them and stuff like
God.
That.
We had a case like that in Haunted where there was two doors into a bedroom.
Yes, you did. So there's a few things that were like, but also I've had when he was young, when he was a baby, so we had two kids, he was a baby and we just moved in and we were very tired, obviously, and everything was up in the air and lots of stress. But me and my wife together heard a baby crying and then went into both of our children's rooms and both of our children were asleep.
Now, and so this is interesting. Did you have a baby monitor on?
Yes. So I think like we could, but also we sometimes heard it with not on the baby monitor. Sometimes okay. we'd hear the crying coming from somewhere else. And the someone tweeted me from my village and said the people who live next door to you, which used to be the same house, when they had a baby, they said the same thing happened in the house. God. That they had
I've got a shiver down my spine there.
So that's quite a good one.
But there is this intriguing thing, though, about phantom noises and baby monitors and about right. baby monitors picking up baby monitors in other people's houses and
yes.
hearing noise. And apparently, like when baby monitors were first invented, they were invented because of this thing, what was he called? Charles Lindbergh. He was a pilot who'd flown across the Atlantic, I think. And, you know, in those days, this was back in the 30s, and it was like, you know, going to the moon, an incredible achievement. And he became very rich. And then one day, some people kidnapped his child from an upstairs yeah. room. And they took him off, and eventually, very sadly, the baby died. And it was a horrendous, awful case. But after that, the baby monitor was invented because people were so nervous about this happening to their child.
Right.
But it had this kind of offshoot kind of thing of like people hearing these phantom noises from other people's baby monitors. So actually, whereas it was meant to reassure people, it engendered more anxiety that people became terrified that their baby
they're
was crying.
Spooky as well, because they're spooky because like everything looks spooky on a baby monitor. So if your kid sits up and has their eyes open, you've got that kind of weird bright eye thing. But also there's always lots of weird phantom movements on them as well. So if you're watching it, you kind of think, what's that moving across the room? So there's things that look like ghosts, and yeah, you hear sometimes you feel you've heard something. Sometimes you're obviously tuned into someone else's or someone's hacked. There's those instances where people have hacked.
Oh, yeah, some really sinister things. Yeah, yeah.
Started talking to the kids. But so we've had that in this house, and it has stopped the minute we stopped being tired, and it stopped the minute we didn't have a baby. No, we don't get babies crying. I think we might have heard it a bit the other day again, but it was the weird thing was that we both heard it at the same time.
But don't you think the kids are creepy? Full stop. I think that period of being a parent in those early days just feels to me like totally full and redolent with quite creepy moments where yeah. a child says something that seems like to come from a very old soul, you know, sort of that yeah. that kind of wisdom, and you know, just like you say, lots of moments where they just shoot bolt upright in the night and say something in their sleep, and you know, or ectoplasmic kind of projectile vomit.
They are scary. I'm terrified. My daughter told me that a few months ago, she said, you're going to be the next person who dies in our family.
Oh, God.
But I think yeah. she just meant because I'm the oldest. But it very much felt like a sort of gypsy curse.
Yeah.
Living every month.
Or a threat.
I think that she might kill me. And then the other thing that happened, which again is this, I mean, that in the Haunted show, I recognised like a lot of the stuff came when people thought they were asleep or had just woken up, and you get that all the things that are slightly spooky that happened to me, apart from the baby scream, which we were always tired, have been like waking up. The other day, my wife shouted no in her sleep, and which she does quite a lot, and I was sure I was awake. And my son walked into the room, which is weird because he's got a gate on his room, so he can't get out. He walked into the room and then stood just in a corner looking into the corner. And it was 100% solid my son, absolutely him. And I was going, Ernie. And he just looked away. He was looking in a corner.
Oh, no.
And I reached out to get him, and then he disappeared. And
oh, my God.
It felt like 100% real, which is what all these people say. Yeah. It obviously wasn't. It was obviously a dream, but I felt like, you know, I was doing, I felt like, I don't know if I even reached out. I don't know whether how far it went, but that, you know, people, if he had then died 2 days later, we'd have gone, oh my goodness, that was a premonition of his death. So occasionally that must happen. And then there's one, I think it was in one of your shows where someone said they'd seen, or maybe it's someone online actually. I've been talking about ghosts a lot. That someone said that they'd seen their dad, the ghost of their dad 5 days before their dad died. There's one on yours where the kitchen gets pulled apart, but at the same time as the mother dies, doesn't it?
I think so. No, totally. I mean, but have you had sleep paralysis ever?
Yeah. So I've experienced like a hag sitting on me, strangling me. I've had lucid dreaming. So that guy, there's a great one about South Africa and a guy who's not that interested in apartheid, who's a student who keeps on coming downstairs and seeing the clock has at different times back and forth, and then walks back upstairs. I don't want to ruin it, but he's greeted by a life-size Gollywog, that's reaching out to get him.
That's the I think that's the episode people talk about most. And the intriguing thing about that is that when you're looking at it, you can see, I mean, as an outsider, you feel it seems clear to us that he's in a dream, he's in a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fear he felt was so real that even though he is, I mean, he's an entirely rational guy and he sort of doesn't believe in ghosts, but he cannot get over that level of fear. And so he can't ever convince himself it was a dream.
Yeah,
and you see the power of fear at that moment.
Well, but also it's such a brilliant. I mean, you handle it so. I mean, you're brilliant at this job. You're absolutely brilliant because you make it spooky, but you present it in such a great way. But you also get to the nub of it, and you know you're talking about how it's a metaphor for what's going on in South Africa at the time. But it absolutely is. It absolutely. I mean, you discuss it with someone, but it absolutely is a man. You know, whose internal guilt is about this, the whole situation that he's living in and not caring about or not particularly caring about. And then it's sort of brought to life in his imagination. But, you know, I've had dreams like that that have seemed that real and where I've had lucid dreams where you're able to do things in the dreams and then those have turned into non-lucid dreams. And I've had a dream where I've woken up 7 or 8 times, convinced I'm awake and then woken up again, you know, and it seemed absolutely real each time to the extent that I'm not sure that I'm not still in that dream and I'm about to, I might just wake up now. It was 20 years ago, but this would be a very long portion of the dream.
Sleep paralysis.
But a lot of people have just woken up or just gone to bed when they see these things. I guess what's fascinating about the poltergeist cases is there's usually a teenage girl, isn't it? Is it ever a teenage boy?
Well, it is sometimes, but it takes us into very interesting territory. And that's one of the things that we've covered in the series, really, this idea of why do we have this thing as a society of obsessing about this kind of haunted teenage girl. And you know, is there genuinely something in that? I mean, are poltergeists literally attracted to teenagers? Or are we somehow kind of manufacturing this, you know? And I mean, certainly when you look at the newspaper coverage of the time, it's really salacious and really quite creepy. You've got this idea of like, you know, vivacious teenager and her spooky lover. And you know, we turned up newspaper articles from like local newspapers in America. It spread everywhere, but they were constantly going on about like pert Bobby Soxer and vivacious teenager. And it was incredibly sexualized and felt really inappropriate now. And so you have this situation where you've not only got Shirley kind of, you know, traumatized by the idea of the poltergeist, but also traumatized by the press coverage of it. And she gets stuck between these two things, what's happening to her, but also how it's portrayed.
Yeah. But the other explanation is that the girls are attempting to get, you know, some kind of either recognition or attention. There's that case that I got. There's the case of the, was it a mongoose or something in the wall? The talking mongoose in the wall. That's another teenage girl
Jeff the talking mongoose. It's an amazing story. Yeah, in a very isolated house on the Isle of Man, I think it is, and they had streams of journalists coming to see this talking mongoose, and Harry Price, the greatest ghost hunter of like the 30s and 40s, coming to investigate. And yeah, I mean, it was allegedly a mongoose that was chatting about theology and could speak various languages, and they believed ultimately, I think, that it was probably an act of ventriloquism by this teenage girl. But I mean, I think, you know, the Enfield case is one of the most famous examples of teenage girls being sort of scrutinized to see whether it's real or whether they are hoaxing. And I think what all of those cases have in common that ours doesn't is that the girls were unhappy and the family was unhappy. And there's a quote from a great book, Colin Wilson's book, Poltergeist, which is kind of like, you know, the sort of industry Bible. And he talks about a poltergeist never happens to a happy family. But actually, in Battersea, it's very, very hard to see how this family is unhappy. They seem to be a kind of solid unit, a quite happy family. So that's where you kind of have to probe to see, are there any unhappinesses? Because on paper, it does seem very different to the other cases where you see like kind of obviously troubled people. And I mean, you look at like Janet now from the Enfield haunting, who I think is probably in her late 40s or 50s. And I mean, you know, I don't want to pass judgment, but when you see the few interviews that she's done, she looks like someone who's quite unhappy and has had quite a hard life. I mean, she looks sort of like it's taken its toll on her. Whereas Shirley doesn't. I mean, Shirley is a kind of amazing, sprightly, kind of bouncy 80-year-old now.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, there's a chance, I suppose, that you could be doing stuff without consciously doing it, right? Without knowing you're doing it. So you could be so into it yourself, you don't know that it's you that's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, and there's the whole area of dissociative behavior where you have like sort of, you know, what used to be called split personalities, you know, the idea of compartmentalized things where somebody is doing something and has absolutely no idea that they're doing it, you know. So,
yeah.
I mean, once you start delving into possible scientific explanations for poltergeist stuff, that's properly fascinating psychologically as well. But I think what's quite hard to get around with our case is this thing of the multiple witnesses. You've got lots of people and not just a family. You've got, you know, the ghost hunter Harold Chibbett who's there. You've got journalists witnessing stuff. I mean, we've got a journalist spending the night in Shirley's bed and leaving the next day convinced she's witnessed a poltergeist. You know, so you have lots of moments where you have an outside witness come in, which makes the whole thing more complicated.
But, you know, why is it not happening all the time, Danny? Why is it only happening?
Well, this is the good question. Yeah,
why aren't all the ghosts coming back? Why, I'm definitely coming. If I can come back, I'm going to come back and I'm going to come to you, first of all. If I can come back, I'm going to push things. I just push things around. I'll do whatever I can do to make it clear it's me. I think I'll go first.
I've heard skeptics come up with some great questions like, why, you know, if ghosts literally just were people coming back from dying, why aren't hospitals just rammed with ghosts? You know? Because most people don't die at home these days. And also, why aren't ghosts naked? Because clothes don't die, you know. So these kind of questions that skeptics will chuck at you, but to spoil your fun.
and from the Haunted series, I mean, there's like 10 episodes, 8, 10 episodes.
Yeah, 10 episodes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's an awful lot of work that's gone in there because it's research. They're very well, they're all beautifully produced, these podcasts. But it feels like a lot of research has gone in. Did it take you a long time were you driven behind that or did you have a team of people helping you put all that together?
We did have a team, but it was a complete labor of love, certainly. And, you know, I mean, Haunted was one of those things that you do without really being paid properly at all because you're in love with the subject and you put it out there. And thankfully, a lot of people have enjoyed it. And I know it's brought a lot of people to the Battersea Poltergeist. I mean, Battersea Poltergeist is being done on a proper BBC budget. So, you know, the kind of ambition of it is achievable. And we've been able to have, you know, like Toby Jones as the ghost hunter and Daphne Keane from his Dark Materials as Shirley and the brilliant Alice Lowe and Bern Gorman and Calvin Denver, all these kind of great people. So that's amazing that we've done this on a sort of a proper budget and have been able to do it properly. Yeah. Like Haunted was just crazy. Like I remember going to like Aberdeen to do one thing, like flying up and back in a day and, you know, just like, you know, bonkers. Yeah.
Well, out of all those stories, do you have a favorite one or one that you do you have ones that you suspect? Oh, right. Okay. I don't think the one in the Shepton Mallet prison, for example, felt the guy who got the cigarette burn. Felt very much like a guy who wanted to get in the newspapers and was prepared to put a cigarette on his own hand to do that. Whereas other ones seemed harder to explain.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think there was a point making Haunted where I felt like because we were talking to skeptics each week about stuff and they were kind of loading me up with all these different scientific explanations, I did find like I went for a time of people would tell me their ghost stories and I'd go, ah, that's probably a sleep thing. And you kind of feel like you have a lot of explanations. But then when we came to the end of the series, we made this one that was in an old hospital, doesn't exist anymore, in London. And it was a nurse who'd had these experiences that were poltergeist experiences. And it involved things being thrown around a seemingly empty room and seeing a ball of light flying, floating across very slowly in front of her. And it was all connected to this patient that she'd lost, who she felt had suffered too much, that his life had been prolonged too much and he should have been allowed to die peacefully sooner. And she felt guilt about that. But her experiences were witnessed by about four nurses. So these four nurses saw the ball of light and witnessed the things being thrown around the room and opened a door and went into a room and were confronted by this sort of thing that chilled them all to the bone, this kind of mixture of atmosphere and freeziness and just a feeling and, you know, that feeling that people can't put their finger on. But the fact that all these people had experienced it together was... that was the most head scratcher of all of the cases, I think. That's the one where I walked away from it going, I don't think we offered an adequate skeptic explanation. I feel like with all most of the others, we, you know, I still leave the door totally open and it absolutely could have been paranormal. But I felt like we offered a potentially convincing skeptic explanation for the others. But that was the one that was hardest to pin down.
Sure. And I guess what's interesting about it as well, because it's more, I think there's more to it. It's just, it's a fascinating subject. And I think it's sort of endlessly fascinating. And it's a great thing to have landed on, I think. But I think in that, you know, in the one, the Shepton Mallet one, to find out about the GIs being sentenced to death. You know, that's a social history that people wouldn't be aware of. You know, that there was that American GIs were coming over, committing crimes during the war, and then being sort of executed very quickly in Chepton Mallet. You know, it's
crucially that it was black GIs and that they were being disproportionately killed. A lot of crimes. You know, I mean, I think there were black GIs being blamed for crimes committed by white GIs, and you know, right. being hanged in their place. And so that was interesting. And you know, but actually. You know, the sort of history of hauntings does plunge you into interesting social territory. And there's a guy called Roger Clark, you might know, who wrote A Natural History of Ghosts, which is a brilliant book that I'd highly recommend to anyone to read as a kind of entry level to the kind of history of why we believe in ghosts. But he talks about us kind of getting the ghosts we deserve. We get ghosts for certain times. And so like the 18th century is full of ghosts obsessed with wills and codicils and, you know, kind of cracking, where was that will buried? You know, and then, you know, obviously you have the ghosts of the war dead after the First World War and the Second World War, and you have that people being obsessed with trying to contact the sons and husbands and fathers they've lost, you know.
Sure.
And now I sort of feel like we are plunged into a time of great uncertainty again. You know, we've had the whole kind of Trump era, the Brexit era, and we're living in kind of very conflicted, turbulent times. And I feel like you are seeing this kind of upsurge in paranormal interest. There's a boom in horror movies, you know, and I think it's a time when people are very interested in ghosts because it taps into that uncertainty, I think.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. We'll talk about some other stuff. But, yeah, do check out both Haunted and Battersea Park.
Can I just tell you, though, that my wife yes. my wife is so scared she's never listened to Haunted or Battersea Poltergeist. And even though I've tried to force her to listen to them, even though she features in Battersea
she
Poltergeist.
Does.
But she's such a scaredy cat that the other night I was here in my shed working away and I had the blinds down, so the no light was shining out. And she was convinced, it's quite new blind, so it was new to her. And she was convinced that there was nobody in the shed and I wasn't in the house. And she became convinced that I'd been killed in the garden. And rather than going to check, looking for my murdered body, she locked the door of the house to protect her and the children. And so then called me and she was like, oh, you're alive. And I was like, yeah, I'm alive. I'm in the shed. But she locked me out of the house in case
I was planning my new life.
Lying dead in the garden. So that's what a scaredy cat she is.
Yeah, but I walk the dog at night, and I you know, there's a point where I shined a torch and thought I saw like a woman, and now in my memory it's like a woman and her kids and stuff. It probably was just a woman, and then I turned around a bit, and then she'd gone, and then the other day there was a gate there that was just open that's never usually open that was kind of creaking back and forth, and so the minute you sort of spook yourself with something, yeah. It's really hard not to then observe 100 other things at that same place. So I completely understand why people get that association, and then you're already scared. And it must go back to, you know, it's understanding the beginning of religion as well as the beginning of ghosts. If we were living on the savannah and it was pitch black at night time, and if you left the fire, you'd be eaten by some terrible yeah. creature that would rip you apart that you couldn't see. You would start creating religions to stop you, A, stop you doing it, but B, to explain it. And you'd also be, you know, you'd be wary of things that had led to people dying or whatever. So it's all really understandable how the human mind could have created
it. We talk about the monkey brain and the lizard brain. You know, the lizard brain is meant to be the oldest part of the brain, the kind of that bit from back in those days, the fight or flight mechanism, and that protects us from predators like around the campfire, like you say. And that is incredibly powerful. That always wins out. And all these things, so many of the things that people describe when they feel like they've seen a ghost are very physical things. You know, the hairs standing on your neck, all these things. And they have reasons dating back to those times. You know, when the hairs stick up on your neck, that's to trap heat, to keep you warmer, you know. And even shitting yourself actually has a function. It makes you less attractive to predators, you know. These are things that our body has designed. So fear is this integral part of our body. And fear... Yeah.
Not
so
just
often,
predators, are they? Not just predators. It makes you less attractive to other people as well. And
it's true.
It's true,
you know.
To most of them, some people like it.
Anyone who's ever done that on a date will know that. But no, I mean, you know, so often, you know, you can cite fear as a major factor in a haunting, I think.
Yeah. Well, look, it's great you found this, I think, a very Danny Robbins niche, because actually the first time I saw you and Dan Tetzel and some other people were doing a ghost hunter comedy show at the Edinburgh Fringe, which is where just just before we started doing That Was Then, This Is Now. That's why. So you've always been obsessed with this idea, both for comedy and in reality.
And I was just going to say, I think it stems back to childhood. I grew up in a household that was entirely atheist, and my mum had been a Catholic, and so when she and then she sort of renounced it at university. And so when we used to go to my grandparents, I would see all these Catholic icons on the walls, and I was fascinated by the idea of belief. And so I've always, I think, wanted to be part of a gang that believed, you know. And I've at various points in my life, I've sort of found myself investigating, you know, religious sects and ghost believers. And I love that. But I also think the other really seminal experience for me that kind of led me to ghosts probably is that when I was in my early 20s, I had this moment where I thought I was going to die. I had this panic attack, which, you know, I can now in hindsight see was a panic attack, but at the time never had one before and had no idea what it was. And I was convinced I was dying. My heart was pumping out of my chest. I was hallucinating. I could see angels. And I thought in that moment, I thought that was it. And it gave me a really strong and profound fear of death for a long time afterwards, like really kind of debilitating and controlling in a sort of a whole year of my university career. And I think ever since then, I've had this little kind of this fear of death that ticks in my brain and a kind of a need to kind of somehow try and understand it and explain it. And I sort of feel like death is at the heart of all ghost belief. Ghosts are a way we've created to try and explain death to us. And, you know, in the past, that absolutely was a crucial part of the, you know, the movement from life to death, was this idea that people still existed afterwards. And so I feel like as much as ghosts are frightening, I sort of almost feel that they are comforting as well, like that idea of life after death. And I certainly in Haunted, I met some people who were seeing the ghost of their husband in their house and finding it deeply comforting. And that's, you know, in those moments, the last thing you want to do is say it's not a real ghost, because that was, you know, like, that was like a lifeline to them. It was crucial.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
I should ask, because I do ask many of my guests this, have you ever seen a ghost, Danny?
I haven't, and I think that's what keeps me going as well. I think it's that I'm living vicariously through all these people because I'm kind of desperate to see one. No, I haven't, it's sort of a source of a bit of disappointment to me, really. I've got two things. I can't sing, and I would love to be in a band, and I've never seen a ghost. I would love to see a ghost. Those are my two great tragedies of my life.
Okay, well, let's talk about, because we've done a lot of other, and always, with even people I know, I'm always amazed. I suppose when you come back to them and see everything they've been up to when you haven't necessarily seen them for a little while. But you've done so much stuff in your writing career, beyond all of this, in your comedy career. You have had a number 11 hit. Do you say you don't want to be in a band? You've got to number 11. In some charts. I don't know any more than that. What's the story behind that?
We got to number 11 in the UK charts in the days when that counted. Like, I think it was like 2003 or something. And it was by accident. It's a good story. So Dan Tetzel, who you know all too well.
I do.
He was walking through a branch of HMV and he heard this song playing and he was like, I recognize that voice. What's that? Is that a sample from something? And he went, hold on a minute. We wrote that. And this DJ had sampled this sketch that we'd done from a show called Barking on Channel 4, which, no, you won't remember. But Marcus Brickstock, who worked as part of the Club Seal sketch team with us, he performed this sketch and Dan and I had written it with him. And this DJ had nicked it. Basically, his friend had put this sketch on his answer phone and the DJ had sampled the answer phone. So he had no idea where it came from. So then we rocked up and said, actually, sorry, mate, that's our sketch. And we had to go through this whole kind of legal battle and get agents involved. And we had like people sending us these things where they were kind of trying to claim that every time in the song it meant ooh, ooh, ah, ah, did that count as a lyric? So even though our sample was really the only words in the song, he was sort of trying to claim we only wrote 50% of it. But at the end of it, we got a few thousand pounds out of it. And he was on Top of the Pops performing it. Because it got to number 11, and we said, like, can we come on Top of the Pops with you? And he wouldn't let us. He's called DJ Decline, and it was called I Don't Smoke the Reefer, and it was a really massive garage track. It's on lots of garage compilations, and I think it was kind of, it came out again recently, a kind of remix. So you know, so if you hear that's us, and DJ Decline, if you're listening, you should have let us on Top of the Pops.
Yeah, he declined.
He really
that's
did.
What, yeah, that's yeah, yeah. Right. He's got to live by his name. He's a DJ who declines. And you were also, in the music terms, nearly in a band. You came second in the UK Air Guitar Championship.
I did. I had a brief phase of doing lots of air guitar, actually. I had this friend who ran a club night. He still runs a club night called Club de Fromage and Feeling Gloomy at the Islington Academy, which is like one of the kind of last kind of big London clubs that's still going strong. But he got very into air guitar and he sort of got the franchise for doing the UK Air Guitar Championships, I think. But we had a band called Satan's Underpants and we performed and we used to do Beastie Boys Fight for Your Right to Party. And I'd wear a big blonde permed wig and it was great. I loved it. Yeah.
The only second, though, you're disappointed. I mean, that's a very rich talent.
Well, we were robbed, absolutely robbed. Yeah, but I think it is me vicariously living out my rock star dreams because I'm horrifically unmusical, like to the point where when I was a kid, my guitar teacher told my mum to stop sending me because it was a waste of money. And I don't think I've ever quite got over that. And being totally and utterly tone deaf to the point where, like, you know, I can't sing with a group of people because it just puts everybody else off, you know. Do you know when you go to a pantomime and at the end you have to like clap along?
Yeah.
I can't do that. I can't clap in time. So I have to pretend.
Maybe you're a ghost. Have you thought of that? That maybe you died when you saw those angels, you died. And the rest of it is you just living your life thinking you're still alive. But, you know, you come second. That's a second in the Air Guitar Championships. That would never happen. Your TV debut was in Let's Make a Baby, which was a fake reality show that you convinced people was real. Is that?
That's
is
right. Yes, yeah,
so, I haven't heard about this.
No, okay.
So that, so much we haven't talked about in our lives.
Notched up a few column inches in its day, but basically they set me the challenge. It was again a while back, and it was kind of when reality TV was really just kind of kicking off in a big way. And they set me the challenge of marketing the most offensive reality TV known to humankind, and seeing if I could sell it at MIPCOM, the big TV festival in Cannes. And seeing if I could get people involved to take part. And I guess it was to sort of show how extreme reality TV could go. But basically the premise was that it was a reality TV show about creating a baby. And then the other day, I mean, this is about maybe a few months ago, people sent me links to a show that is actually happening now. So yeah. This is probably like 15 years down the line and it's happening, you know, so.
So was your show that two people just randomly got together to make the perfect baby?
Yeah, essentially.
And is that the actual show?
Yeah,
it is. It's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah.
You should have made the show.
But you know what? After doing that, though, I was then offered a reality TV show that was way, way, way more offensive than that. I went into a meeting with a TV company and they asked my agent to come with me, which I should have known was a warning sign because you don't normally have that. Like, why would the agent have to come for like sort of safeguarding kind of thing? So we both went into this room and sat with these two guys. And they said to me, Danny, great, loved the show you did. We were wondering how you would feel about catching a sexually transmitted disease for a reality TV show. And I said, not great, not really that good about that. And then they said, okay, that's fine, that's okay, that's cool. How would you feel in this case about going out to a nightclub, picking up a girl, bringing her back to your house and having sex with her, and then afterwards you could tell her you had an STD to see how she reacted? I mean, you wouldn't have one. You could just tell her that. How would you feel about that? I mean, it was just, I you know, it's about the one time in my career I've walked out of a meeting. It was just jaw-dropping, and thank God it didn't happen. But, you know.
Did the show get made with someone else?
No, it didn't.
We used to just see who said yes to that.
There's those things that you're offered. I mean, there was another one I was offered, which was about pretending to be a pig and living as a pig for a week. And eating out of like a trough and stuff like that.
Right.
And that one did happen. I don't know if anyone remembers it, but there was a show where people pretended to be a farmyard animal. But like, you know, I remember being like kind of asked, you know, like I had someone from the BBC calling up and saying, please, please do this. And I was like, no, I'm not going to be a pig. But the STD one, I'm very glad to say, didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'll happen. And then maybe after it's been on Rahalastapur, that will be back, that idea.
There you go.
I'm sure it had a social conscience of, you know, beyond the picking up a woman in order to, if you'd said, yeah, I'm happy to have a sexually transmitted disease, would they have then said, and how would you feel about going and picking up a girl from a club and having sex and then telling her she's got a sexually transmitted disease? Do you think that's where they were going with it?
I mean, I don't know. It's just horrific. I mean, it's frightening to think that maybe there were some people who said yes to it. I don't know. I hope not.
But it feels like a Chris Morris thing where Chris Morris would check how far.
Yeah,
some, you know, it would be weird for him to pick on some, you know, unknown new people who are keen to get into TV. But so what's the weirdest things you've ended up doing? You were mentioning before we came on air that something wasn't in my notes that you claimed to have done on TV, which sounds worse than having a sexually transmitted disease on TV. Is this true that you told me you had masturbated on TV?
It is true, yeah.
What was that about?
In a way, I'm surprised this doesn't come up more often in conversation. But after I made that, it was for the Mischief Strand on BBC Three, and after I made that one about pitching the reality TV format, they asked me to do this thing about sperm donation, and it was about this big kind of scandal that was going on at the time, which was about they were making it so that people could discover who their sperm donor was, so that after donating sperm, then like sort of 25 years later or whatever, somebody could come and track you down and find that you were their father. And and it was something that was putting huge amounts of people off donating sperm because they wanted to do it anonymously. And so we started making this show about trying to encourage men to go out and become sperm donors, and I was traveling the country in this kind of Winnebago, this one of those what do they call it? Airstream Winnebagos, you know, the kind of funky ones with the silver foil kind of on the outside. Yeah. And traveling all around, like going up to like Hadrian's Wall and the Lake District and then all over the place. Like, we were on Giant's Causeway at one point outside Belfast and trying to convince men to donate sperm. And it, like, looking back, it was like really unhygienic and quite grim that men would come in to this Winnebago and donate sperm. They would sort of do it there in the Winnebago, like with me kind of just outside, kind of whistling outside the door. Again, it's one of those ones where you go like, why did I let people do it? Make me do this. But yeah, they did incredibly. They kind of filmed me producing a sperm sample, like only from like the shoulders up. I mean, I have to say, like, you did not see, you know, the business end of it.
You had to perform in front of was there a cameraman in the room?
No. I think you were just filming yourself. Knocked off shot.
Yeah.
Of me getting a sperm sample. And I don't know. I'm not quite sure how I feel about it now, whether it was a good thing to do or not.
So if I want to see your cum face, I can find a piece of footage.
Thankfully, it's not on the internet. I don't know. You'd have to come to my house and I could show it to you.
Yes.
Hidden away on a DVD in a box in my attic, I think.
It's difficult. I mean, that's why, you know, porn stars are in demand, because it's difficult to do those things while you're being watched, unless that's what you particularly enjoy.
It's funny, I've never had a lot of shame about sort of things like that. I mean, I've been naked on telly a few times. I think in that same program, I was naked with a group of ice hockey players in Denmark, I think. But, you know, I've done that a few times. I don't mind that too much. I feel like I'm able to kind of disconnect from, you know, me off stage and me on stage with that. But I don't know. I still don't know if it was a great thing to do to give a sperm sample on television. But
and did the sperm get then used to make a child anyway? Well, actually, it's almost your idea.
But that's an interesting point. Actually, the producers were putting a bit of pressure on me to actually donate the sperm, and I didn't feel comfortable doing that because that was at the point where I was talking about actually having kids with my wife, and I didn't like the idea that, you know, somebody would come and track me down in 25 years.
And then they say, well, do you want to see the moment that you were created? Here's a minute.
Here we go. This is ground zero. So I kind of, you know, I think they were a bit disappointed that I didn't actually donate the sperm, but I'm glad I didn't do that. I think it's very easy when you're young and trying to get ahead in TV or whatever, it's very easy to get caught up in doing things that you don't necessarily feel comfortable about. And I mean, you obviously do see that in reality television with some of the kind of awful things. Do you remember a woman called Kinga who was on Big Brother?
Yeah, very much so.
And you know, this thing of her pleasuring herself with a bottle on Big Brother. And you know, I met her for my reality TV program, about documentary about it, and talked to her and just about how traumatized that was and what a huge impact that had on her life. And you know, they can be very damaging moments, those things where somebody gets caught up in the moment and carried away, and the TV company are benefiting from it and the person is very definitely suffering from it.
No, of course. Well, you know, it's an exploitative business we work in, which hopefully will become less so. But it is interesting to hear that, you know, obviously there's all the Me Too stuff we've heard about, but there's equally that sort of grey area where people are, you know, desperate for work and desperate to get that leg up on the ladder. And then you end up doing some things that, and especially when you present with it in the moment, it was not in any way the same really, but I did a show called Best Man Speech, which was presented to me as like, oh, you're going to meet a guy who's going to get married and his best man, and you're going to help the guy write his speech. But then it was, you know, I thought, oh, that'd be interesting. And then it was hardly any of it was that. And it was just a load of putting him through a load of stupid stunts, like he'd broken his arms and had to help him make a phone call. You know, he had to persuade someone to make a phone call. You go, well, this isn't anything to do with,
I mean, the thing
this is just you wanting to humiliate a guy. But you, once you've signed on the line, you're sort of in. Luckily, absolutely nobody saw that show. It went out on ITV4 or something like that.
This is the thing, you do not have control, you know, you do sign your life away. And I remember working with a producer years back who'd always talk about, oh, just do that and I'll have an option in the edit, you know. And you knew that as soon as you did the thing that he wanted you to do that you didn't want to do, that was the one that was going to be on screen, you know. I don't know, I mean, it's hard. I mean, a lot of it comes down to kind of having an integrity, doesn't it? Like, I sort of feel like, you know, when I'm editing interviews of people, you know, I you could easily go one way and make them sound like they're saying something else, but you have to have an integrity to not only to sort of the moment, but I mean, you know, maybe they did say things that they sort of perhaps, you know, didn't phrase that well, was a bit clumsy, or that they maybe shouldn't have said. And you feel like, you know, do you want to put that out there? You know, do you want to sort of like, you know, make them look bad, you know, and you kind of feel like you don't, you know, so you don't include that.
I know. Well, not, you know, that's how we work on this show as well. Obviously, when it's live, you're stuffed. But, you know, we absolutely let people take stuff out, and often have taken things out. And in one case, not put out a show because I felt the guest came across so badly that it wouldn't have been fair to him. But anyway, let's move on to, you have worked with Basil Brush, and that is, I'm very interested in puppets.
Yeah.
That's what I'm most interested in.
So Dan Tetzel and I, we kind of effectively relaunched Basil Brush in like the early 2000s, I think it was. And, you know, he'd been out of fashion for a long time. His glory days were long behind him. And then, this company had bought the rights and they wanted to relaunch him. And we wrote the pilot episode and we wrote quite a few episodes after that as well. So we sort of kind of effectively kind of had a big say in what he was going to be like. And they were desperate for him to be this kind of youth icon and to not say like, you know, boom, boom. And, you know, I say, hello, Mr. Roy. We sort of fought really hard to keep all that and to keep him like that. But my kids have become obsessed with Basil Brush because we've got this book about him on our shelf and they keep pulling it out and making me do jokes in a Basil Brush voice, you know.
Here's the 21st century Basil Brush. But there he is.
Look at that.
That's Law Fox.
That's very good.
Is it? Yeah, Fox Law with Law Fox. He may be based on someone with a similar name. hello, it's me, Lord Fox. And he tries, and I try to get him to say boom, boom. But the thing with Basil Brush is he wasn't a ventriloquist at this. Boom, boom would be a very bad catchphrase for it. Doom, doom. You know, it doesn't work. So it sounds like doom, doom. There you go. Another one of my puppets.
I did weirdly find myself doing all of Basil's interviews for a while. I'd be doing like these web chats for The Guardian, being Basil and answering people's questions, you know. And, yeah, I mean, I love Basil as a character. And
I loved him so much as a kid. I don't know, because you're a bit younger than me. I don't know whether it would be such a big deal. But it was like when I was growing up, it was absolutely a miss. And Roy North, there was my Mr. Roy was the guy that I remember being with him. But I just absolutely loved him as a kid. I think he was one of the puppets was in that Covent Garden Museum of Childhood or Toy Museum there. And it was actually kind of seeing Basil Brush in real life was actually quite a weird moment for me, because it meant so much to me as a kid. So actually working with him and writing for him is insane. Was it the same guy doing the... because he gave up, didn't he, by that stage.
Ivan Owen, I think he'd passed away by that stage. But the man who was doing it then kind of had ginger hair and a sort of slightly fox-like quality to him. I think he was someone who'd worked on cruise ships and was a kind of, you know, entertainer, and then suddenly landed this gig. But there's a great story about Ivan Owen, the original Basil Brush, negotiating Basil's contract with the BBC. And apparently he used to drive up in a Rolls Royce, wind the window down, and Basil would stick out the window and he'd sign the contract with Basil. And I don't know if that's true or not, but if it is, then it's absolutely brilliant that they made BBC executives come and stand outside Broadcasting House and hold a contract to the window of the car as a fox signed.
See, it's not. He was under the table. That's not. You can't. He didn't even sit next to him and do it.
Oh, don't be a skeptic, Rich.
What kind of?
Allow the magic to persist. It was a real fox.
I want the magic of ventriloquism to persist. Not just going, oh, I'll just hide under the table and do his voice. Apps. All puppeteers and ventriloquists are perverts and offenders. I think that's my theory. Apart from Nina.
Apart from Nina Conti, definitely.
I'm not even sure about it. And me.
Of course, they used to do ventriloquism on the radio, didn't they?
My ventriloquism does go out as a podcast. You can enjoy it as a podcast if you want. There is a filled version, but you can. People do. I don't know how many download the. It's quite confusing because most of my puppets sound quite similar, so it's better to have. It's better to watch it with the puppets.
I wrote it,
but then you don't see how bad the ventriloquism is if you don't watch it. So you know it's a double edged sword.
I wrote a joke about a ventriloquist for my play End of the Pier that Les Dennis.
I was going to just mention that.
Les had to deliver it, but it was one of my favourite jokes that he did really nicely every night. But it was about he was playing this old school comedian called Bobby Chalk, and he was like, I had a fight with ventriloquist once. He was giving it all that, which only works on video. But for those listening in audio, I'm now holding my hand up and making it.
Yes.
A little chatting symbol.
Don't help the audio idiots. How did that play go? The idea of a kind of an old school comedian, and was his son an alternative comedian? Was that the idea?
Yeah. So I mean, Les played an old school comic of the kind of, you know, Cannonball, Little and Large era, who'd had 20 million viewers on a Saturday night, that kind of level of fame. And then sort of become a pariah after making a racist joke, essentially. And then he had a son played by Blake Harrison, who came along, who was kind of very much a sort of Michael McIntyre kind of, you know, big new TV comic, you know. And at first you think that he's, you know, the opposite, the polar opposite, and incredibly kind of left wing. And then what emerges during the play is that, you know, he's been involved in this incident, which is actually a racial assault on a guy, and that he actually has all this kind of simmering hatred. And it's kind of about tracing back the roots of how he feels to his, you know, to what happened with his father. And it's kind of, it's exploring, I guess, the kind of the power of comedy to not, you know, comedy can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing. It can be something that can be bullying and victimizing. And that line that comedy needs victims, you know, and I guess it taps into that thing that we sometimes talk about in comedy, that I think it's probably kind of like a term that comedians use. I don't know if people know it so much outside, but about punching up and punching down. You know, that if you're punching up, it's a justified target. It's, you know, satirical. You're attacking the government or whatever. And punching down is, you know, like picking on people, you know, like picking on refugees or whatever. And so it was about that kind of idea. And at the end, you have the person that Michael, the younger comedian, attacked, comes back into the picture, and actually he's played by Nitin Ganatra brilliantly on stage, and he performs his own stand-up routine. He sort of hijacks Michael's TV show and performs his own stand-up routine, which is way funnier than Michael's and very powerful, and kind of deals with issues of race from the perspective of being this Bangladeshi guy who's moved to the UK and an immigrant to the UK. So, I mean, yeah, it was amazing. And Les clearly comes from that time when there were a lot of racial jokes told, but Les is very much not that at all. Les is this, I mean, I've never met a nicer man than Les, quite frankly, as you'd probably testify yourself. But you know, it was really interesting to have him play that, and he did it very powerfully.
Yeah, well, they were a great cast. And you do a lot. I mean, we're running out of time, so I'll just quickly mention that. You have written a lot of Radio 4 stuff as well. You've done the Cold Swedish Winter, which was based on your own experience, I presume, of, we did mention it briefly earlier, of marrying a Swedish lady.
I did. I married a Swede and then kind of... Sweden's become a massive part of my life now, really. I think we're now... You know, we've just made the fifth series of The Cold Swedish Winter, and I've made various documentaries about Sweden as well. And I find myself endlessly fascinated. It's this idea of a country that is similar to ours, but at the same time, kind of crucially different and sort of exotically different in a way. And I think things work better in Sweden. Like there's an old line, actually, of Lou Reed from a film where he says, "I don't trust Sweden, man. Everything works there." And it's kind of true. Like, Sweden is this brilliantly, brutally efficient country. And my wife's biggest insult for anyone is, it's so inefficient. You know, like when I'm doing the washing up or doing something wrong in the house, why do you have to be so inefficient? And the Swedes have got it cracked. So a lot of the Cold Swedish Winter is about trying to kind of understand how the Swedes have their society so cracked. And that battle between British inefficiency and Swedish efficiency.
It is the Scandinavia is interesting, and I haven't been there very much, but I've been out a little bit with when Talking Cock kind of travelled the world. I don't think I went to Sweden, or did I go to Sweden? God, I don't even remember now. What I found sort of fascinating about one of the Scandinavian countries, because it's sort of slightly removed from the rest of you. You know, with France and Germany and Italy, you sort of feel, I know a little bit about how things work there, but Scandinavia seems, you know, we're not quite as au fait with how it works. And when I went to this premiere in one of the Scandinavian countries, I forget which one, it had all the big, it had quite a big name guy doing it, and all the big stars in Sweden came to watch it. And obviously, as an outsider, you just see all these people who are nobody at all to you. You've never encountered them in any way. And they're all being, people are going, oh, and it sort of gives you a real insight into the nature of, I just remember this really old guy who was basically the Cliff Richard of wherever this country was. And he had a very young girlfriend, and he just looked like an old man wearing moccasins. And you just get, you know, it would be inexplicable why he was with this.
I think you do find that in Scandinavian countries, I think in Germany as well, I found this, that famous people are more humble. Like, you know, pop stars and film stars, they're much more approachable, and they don't have the big ego, because in those countries, and particularly in Scandinavian countries, like, that's really frowned upon to be arrogant. There's this whole thing in Scandinavia called Jantelagen, the law of Jante. And it's basically... it stems back from a novel written in the 30s, but it's this kind of set of laws of don't be, you know that line, don't be a tall poppy. Tall poppies are cut down, you know, like basically don't try and stand out from the crowd. So each rule is like, you know, don't think you're better than anybody else. Don't try and, you know, be clever than anybody else. And it's all about kind of being modest, being mediocre, if you like. And so that's kind of really intrinsic in Scandi society. And, you know, I've talked to like Swedish rappers, you know, and Swedish rappers are like the opposite of bling, you know. They drive a Volvo, and they're just not talking about kind of, you know, who's got the most guns and who's got the most jewelry. You know, it's all about, like, you know, having a sensible house and a nice lifestyle. It is very different, I think.
Yeah. I'm glad you could do so many of those. So five series of that. Rudy's Rare Records you did with Lenny Henry as well. So you're fitting a lot in. You're doing very well. You've masturbated on TV. that'll take over. You've interviewed Morrissey. Haven't even talked about that.
That was a second occasion, by the way. But no, that I mean, oh dear, what's happened to Morrissey? I mean,
When did you interview him?
I interviewed him before he became
the
indie Nigel Farage. I interviewed him, but even then he was very prickly. I went up to Newcastle and interviewed him just before he did a gig up there, and it was for the Culture Show, and they were doing this thing about the greatest living icons, and he was like number three, I think. He was in the top three. And so I was sent up there to interview him, and he was so prickly. Like, you know, he was up against David Attenborough, and he chose this opportunity not to go, great, thanks for the prize. You know, he chose it to take a pop at David Attenborough. And he was like sort of saying, I don't like David Attenborough. And I was like, why? And he went, because he calls animals wild animals. They should call them free animals. They're free. They're not wild. And I was like, Morrissey, you know, please choose your hill to die on. You know, and then I got talking to him about, you know, that song that he did called Irish Blood, English Heart, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite a good song, you know, Irish blood, English heart, I am made of. And there's a line in it about the Queen saluting Oliver Cromwell. And I'm like, where did that come from? That's a really weird line to put into a pop song, full stop, but also didn't really make any sense to me. And he said that the reason was to do with the Queen having a portrait of Oliver Cromwell somewhere in one of her palaces or like in Parliament. I can't even remember what it was now, but... And it really bothered him, you know, because obviously Cromwell was involved in terrible things to Irish people. But the fact that the Queen had a picture of him somewhere was kind of really made him really angry. So he struck me as somebody who kind of finds little things to get very, very angry about. And sort of, you know, he kind of has real bugbears. And he just struck me as someone who's very annoyed all the time, essentially. He was quite a miserable man. And I've heard stories subsequently, like I did a gig in some gigs in Greece, and I was told that the crew that he travels around with are all really miserable, and that he's, you know, he's a passionate vegetarian, isn't he? And he's banned anybody from his tour from eating meat. He won't let them eat meat. And so apparently all of these guys from his crew were going out and secretly eating meat, hiding from him and trying not to get caught. And I think you get sacked if you ate meat. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, it was, at one level, it was amazing to meet him. But now sort of when I sort of hear and see some of the things that he said subsequently, I sort of feel like I could see the roots of a man who was angry and quite bitter about the world.
Yeah, that's sort of interesting to get it that way around. But, you know, you see that a lot with... That's my fear is I see a lot of middle-aged white men who, you know, are losing their power and losing their influence and then become horrible, twisted kids. And then you kind of go, oh, what if that? Will I just wake up one day and that will be me? Or will I be okay? Is the fact I'm aware of it mean I'm going to be okay? You know, or I suppose it's partly because you have social media. You would never have known your friends were turning slightly Brexity or racist or just, you know.
I mean,
the world's so weird at the moment, the kind of things that people get angry about, but it really changes your view of someone when you see them.
No, it's really interesting. And that's part of what I kind of became obsessed with when I was writing the play that Les was in, End of the Pier, about that moment where somebody says or does something that totally irrevocably changes everything. You know, the moment where somebody says the thing in public they should never ever say and their career is over. And it's that the way that we view that person before and after. You know, like, for instance, if you look at pictures of Rolf Harris now, you look at a picture of Rolf Harris from the 70s and you see like evil Rolf Harris now. But back in the day, you wouldn't have seen that. But there's something, it's like a sort of magic eye picture that, you know, you look at it now and you just see it in a totally different way. You see kind of the evil, you know, you go, oh, the evil was there back in the 70s. We could, you know, now we can see it. But at the time you didn't. But there's something, there's a kind of transformation that people go through that moment in the play, we called it cuntification, where that moment where suddenly you go, oh yeah, this person is horrible and evil, you know, but you didn't see it before. And it's the same photograph you're looking at.
It's interesting. Law Fox, it's all there. Danny, it's been so lovely to catch up with you. I can't believe it feels like yesterday we were doing the radio show. The last decade or so has gone much too fast. I would like to heartily recommend that people listen, even though they should be listening to my podcast. I'm going to let them
listen to both simultaneously.
I listened to Haunted, the entire series. I started listening to it yesterday afternoon and finished it like at lunchtime today, so I've pretty much done nothing but listen to Haunted, and it was just gripping. And I don't usually go that far. I don't go that deep unless I'm enjoying it. And the Battersea Poltergeist is also absolutely fantastic and shaping up to be a very I can't wait to find out what happens next, and I am going to listen to that one every week, as you've hooked me in. So I recommend those to everyone. Anything else coming up you want to plug, or is that your focus at the moment?
I mean, I think we're doing another series of Cold Swedish Winter later in the year. But I mean, at the moment, life is very dominated by Battersea Poltergeist, for sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
I was due to have a play on in the West End, which would have been brilliant, but COVID has completely destroyed that. So I had this little sort of fledgling attempt to be playwriting, and I've got a couple that were really close to going on, but you know, waiting now to see if theatre exists as an institution post-COVID.
I think we'll be back, and I hope that will. I hope theatre will be back. I'm at the Clapham Grand on Saturday. That's a theatre. Hopefully, there won't be any people there, but you know, that's not the point, is it? So terrific. Well, good luck with everything. I'm so glad it's going so brilliant for you, ladies and gentlemen. The amazing Danny Robbins. Come and see us at online at the Clapham Grand. I don't know who's going to be next week on Twitch because I haven't booked anyone yet. Thank you very much. Goodbye. See you. You have been listening to Rahulastapur with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Danny Robbins. Thank you to Pest for providing the music. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one. All his hard work on this. Thank you to everyone at Acast, British Comedy Guide, iTunes, Ian Tunes, Ian Amazon, thanks for all your help. Twitch, Ian Twitch, thank you for that. Do check out twitch.tv/RKHerring to watch these live and lots of other stuff as well. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Go to GoFasterStrike.com/badges to become a monthly badger. Help us make more podcasts and more online content. It's going to be great. Please do it, and you get loads of extras and a badge and a membership card. And the feeling inside of helping create beautiful art.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks again for listening to the podcast. RichardHerring.com/ballback/tour or RichardHerring.com/gigs for all of the information on the tour. GoFasterStrike.com for lots of downloads and books and lots of fun. Thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Tell your friends about the show. Tell your friends about the tour. I love you all. I'm out.